Yeah, this is Penn Jillette of the Free FM, CBS FM. 866-570-PEN is the phone number. I get that all the time, although I don't think we're going to bother taking phone calls because we have too exciting a guest. PennRadio@gmail.com, PennRadio.com. Sitting across from me, as he was yesterday, is Lawrence O'Donnell Jr. And in the studio, when we started to do The Aristocrats, right, Provenza and I got the idea, we're going to do The Aristocrats, we're going to have the best, funniest comedians in the world tell this filthy joke. We made a list. You know, it turned out to be over 100 people, but we made a list of the people that we wanted right away and would get it and would understand it. Right in the middle of the list of about 20 people was Robert Schimmel, and he never ended up in The Aristocrats, the rat bastard. But but now he's sitting here with us. And yes, I should say, you wanted to do it. We wanted you to do it.
Oh, absolutely.
Scheduling.
Yeah, no, I wanted to do it. Paul asked me, and just every time you were in the city that you were doing it in, I was on the other side of the country.
And yeah, we were just running around with our home video cameras trying to find people who were home. So the Aristocrat should be called Those Who Were Home Those Days.
Can I ask you, did you understand the concept as soon as it was explained to you? Because I got to say, Penn explained it to me, and I listened, and I knew the Aristocrat's joke, but going to be.
Yeah, you understood it right away, didn't
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
Yeah. We want to crank his headphones up. You have to turn up your volume over there. You're sharing headphones is a thing.
Wow.
Right over there. Jack will do it for you.
Kind of
so
thing you do.
So you're I want to say this right away, so in case we get really excited and into stuff, you
okay.
You're playing the Monte Carlo, the big Lance Burton Theater.
That's right.
And it's this weekend for those people who are here in
yep.
Vegas. And I've only seen you live once. And it was in Vegas, and it's a terrific show. And I bet it's changed a lot since
yes.
I saw it, when, 1948 or something.
Yeah.
It's a long time ago. And you've been through a lot since then.
Yes, I have. And, I was, you know, they say timing's everything in comedy. And in 1999, I won the Comic of the Year Award, which I really don't believe in. But I don't. It's like having
it's worth
a contest.
Mentioning, though.
It's like having it. No, because it fits into the story. But it's like... It's like having a contest to what's better, vanilla or chocolate. If somebody doesn't like chocolate, you could say, but this is Godiva, and it doesn't mean anything. So, you know, how could you win Funniest Male Stand-Up of the Year, and Richard Pryor sitting in the front row, and you're staring at him, like accepting the award, like, what am I doing up here? So, seriously. So I got that. HBO offered me an hour special that I shot. I got a record deal with Warner Brothers Records, and Bill McKeown produced my CDs, which is the same guy that discovered Stephen Wright and did his,
uh-huh.
and Steve Martin. If you look at all of Steve Martin's albums, it says William E. McKeown Presents
uh-huh.
Steve Martin. And then I get offered a sitcom pilot by Fox. Mike Scully, who was running The Simpsons.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Really
I'm a big fan of yours. He goes, let's do a pilot. I do a pilot. It gets picked up for 13 episodes. They fly me to New York at the end of May in 2000 to announce all the fall lineup, and I'm the big sitcom that was premiering that fall, and 5 days later I got diagnosed with cancer, and that was the end of the whole thing.
Now, that's funny. That's a good. That's a good setup.
I actually came here from New York and performed at the Monte Carlo on June 2nd and 3rd. It was the first time I ever performed here. And I was walking back from the farm shops, and I told my dad, I got to get a sweatshirt. I'm freezing. And I had, like, goosebumps. And he said, Bob, it's like 112 out. And I said, Dad, look at me. I'm shaking. Went to the Mayo Clinic on the 5th, and they said, 6 months to live if the treatment doesn't work.
Well, what kind of cancer was it?
Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, stage 3.
What was your 6 month plan?
You know, that changes real fast. It really does, because he said, if it doesn't work, you have 6 months. And he said, now, if I would have told you, this is what he said to me right then. He said, if I would have told you this 6 months ago, what would you have done in the 6 months? I said, why? He said, start doing it today.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, God, because then it's just the first time it really hits you that this could really be it. And the first thing I did, which was really bizarre, is I had a cigarette, and I didn't even smoke. And for some reason, I wanted a cigarette. I figured if there was any time to have a smoke, it would be right after they tell you.
That makes perfect sense.
Perfect. And that was, I have a friend who worked in the circus, and he was the guy who would run into the ring when someone was injured. And he said, whenever someone is injured, whenever someone is panicked, the first thing you do, stick a cigarette in their mouth and light it. Because if they're a smoker, they're going to want it. And if they're not a smoker and don't know it, you want to know that. I think they should have it, Cancer Awards. They have a smoking section right there? Oh, they should.
No. But it really changes a lot, and it changes what you think you're looking for and what you don't. And I didn't want to stop. The TV show thing didn't bother me, but I really wasn't ready to go yet, you know. And they said that if it did work, I had a 51% chance of going 2 years without it coming back. And, you know, when they say survival rate, you know, you survive to me means you live.
Yeah.
Well, that means 5 years. It doesn't mean.
Oh.
Okay.
No, that's what it means.
Yeah.
Seriously.
I just reacted to that like you were telling me.
Yeah. So, but then I met people that were coming up to me saying, I had what you had 17 years ago. And I'm like, oh, so every time I hear something like that, then I start turning around and telling other people that it's not, you know, don't look at statistics because we're individuals and everybody's separate. But there were some upsides to it. I was with my mom and dad when I got diagnosed, and they said that if I was open-minded, I might consider marijuana during chemotherapy because it helps with the the nausea and losing weight and stuff. And I was thinking, this is a dream come true. I got a doctor at the Mayo Clinic telling my parents that I should be smoking pot. I mean, where was this guy like 30 years ago? And my mom, by the way, it works. And I wasn't getting stoned then, and somebody got me some, and I ate 2.5 boxes of ice cream sandwiches at one sitting. And I went for a checkup 2 days later, and they said, you gained 3 pounds. What are you doing? I said, smoking pot and eating ice cream sandwiches. And they said, hey, if that's working for you, then don't stop.
It sounds like a good last 6 months.
What?
Smoking pot and eating ice cream sandwiches.
The bad thing about chemo is they really don't want you to have too much sex. Because you have all those toxins in you, and it can come out in any kind of anywhere anything can come out of. So, even though there's some things I always wanted to try in my life before I died, even me having maybe 6 months left wasn't good enough for my ex-wife. And,
tough negotiator, your ex-wife.
That's really what you want to do if you're going to be dead? Really? You mean another girl that's going to make things better? Yes. Okay, how about just mean another girl and you take a hike? Jeez, she was really something. And I was actually, we were getting divorced while I was on chemotherapy.
Woohoo! You bought the whole package, yeah. Didn't you? You said, let's have all the good first and then all the bad. Let's not mix them up.
See, here's what happened. I'm actually, right before I got diagnosed, I moved to L.A. and I was living with another girl who is now my wife. And then when I got diagnosed and they said 6 months, then I said, geez, you know what? I'm going to go back home because I have kids there, and I wanted to be with them and let them get to spend time with me. So I broke up with my girlfriend, didn't tell her I was sick, and went and asked my wife if I could just come home and said, look, I got maybe 6 months to live. And she just didn't forgive me for living with the other girl already. And, you know, I remember once I was throwing up and laying on the floor in the house and really weak, and I said, honey, could you help me get up to the bed? And she said, where's your girlfriend now?
No, she didn't.
I swear to God.
No, she didn't.
I swear to God.
She's funny.
She said, where's your girlfriend now? And I said, well, you're not going to let her come over. So,
she really did?
Yeah.
Now, has your ex-wife forgiven you for living longer than 6 months?
I think so. She thinks it's a punishment for cheating. You know, it's a funny thing, but cancer really is for people that cheat on their wives. And,
what bracelet is that? I cheated on my wife, and all I got was this lousy bracelet.
Yeah, oh, God. I almost spent the night in jail when we were getting divorced. We were living in Arizona, and they don't know about managers and publicity people and agents and stuff like that, you know? So when you say my manager, my agent gets 10%, then my, because they go by your gross income. They don't know about what show business is. So I said, my agent gets 10%, my manager gets 15%, and they said, well, what does your agent do? I said, he gets me jobs.
Oh, yeah.
Well, what does your manager do? And I said, hey, I've been asking him that for like 10 years. So 15%. Then the publicist gets this. Well, they had a chart up on the wall that had my income from 1999-2000. They picked like the closest year to where you made the most money, and that's how they're going to determine, you know, how you're going to pay. So it's the year that I got the record deal, the HBO special, and the sitcom, plus the personal appearances, and they have Robert Schimmel, and then that number up there, and underneath, and there's a red zero. So her lawyer goes, now, Your Honor, as you can see, Robert earned this amount of money in 1999, 2000, and she earned zero. What does that tell you? And I said, well, it tells me she should get a job because it looks like I'm doing everything. And they told me to shut up. I mean, they really got, they did. They said one more thing and I would be spending the night.
Did you get a joke?
No. And it was a female judge.
Oh.
Whose
yeah.
husband left her for a younger girl. So she already had her own little thing to deal with.
Oh, man. So that divorce went well. And this is while you're having chemo?
Yep. Yep.
Someone is testing you.
Yeah.
We're here interviewing Job.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, I don't want to, if you don't want to dwell on this, I'll just get off it.
I'll
but,
go wherever you want to go.
But the 6 months, you want to spend time with your kids. That's really easy. You want to do wild sex. That's really easy.
Yeah.
What are the things we might not think of spending 2 minutes on it when you spent months on it, thinking about. What were the things that you said, I got to do this?
Live by the ocean.
Oh.
Really?
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
And you did
and
that?
And I said, I'm going to live on the ocean in Santa Monica or Venice, California, for, and I don't care what it costs, but I have to do this, and because I, God forbid, I don't make it. You know, I don't want to be laying in the hospital bed saying I never did it. Isn't that bad? Because I couldn't afford to live on the beach.
Well, Robert, I'm a block away in Santa Monica.
I just lived on Entrada and PCH.
I'm right there.
Right behind
so
Patrick's Fry House.
Next time you have 6 months to live, you can come to my guest room, but you have 6 months to live, okay, when you come into that guest room.
And so when do you find out after you go through chemo that it went okay? Do they have the same kind of dramatic meeting and go, you're in remission, you're all right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I had a big anxiety attack the day I got diagnosed. You know, when he told me, they drew a line on a piece of, on a legal pad and said Hodgkin's disease and non-Hodgkin's. Mm-hmm. And they said, you have non-Hodgkin's. And I said, that's just my luck. I got the one that's not named after the guy. And the doctor said, you're going to be okay. And I said, why? And he said, if you could think of something funny to say while I'm giving you your prognosis. And but that's all I have. What am I supposed to do? You know, when I look at other comics prior and a lot of other guys, and you say, wow, what is it? Their material, their timing, their stage persona, this, that. I look at them and think, what crap did they go through in their life that they're this funny? Because that's where that comes from. It's not from just having an easy life. People like that aren't really that funny. And I just, you know, just had to take it the way it was. And I had a big anxiety attack. I begged him for a Xanax or a Valium, like that moment. And he said no. And
why?
I said, why not? He said, that's not on the protocol for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And I said, no, I don't want a prescription for them. I just want one, just to get me through the night. And he said, well, he said, let me ask you something. He said, if you were fighting like Mike Tyson for the heavyweight championship of the world, what would you do? Would you hire a trainer? Would you get a nutritionalist? Would you start eating right, exercising, getting up in the morning, doing all this stuff, getting a hold of every videotape of every Tyson fight there was to watch so that you knew everything there was about him? So when you stepped into the ring for the fight of your life, you knew every strength and weakness of your foe, or would you take a Xanax? And he really made
like
a lot
Thomas
of sense.
Like Thomas Jefferson, you said, I would not hesitate to choose the latter.
Yeah. I said, can I do all of that? So, and I just decided to go online, research what I had, and I was going to, I never really thought about where I was going to be, because they say you're supposed to, like, visualize yourself in the future, and I tried doing that, and, you know, you get, so I was just taking every day as it came, and that's it. And that's all you really can do.
You know, the Onion had a headline once that really summed up a lot of my thinking that said, man loses cowardly battle with cancer.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's a downside to talking about how heroic the people who survived cancer are? that don't survive, as though if they'd fought a little harder, if they did a little more. Where do you draw the line between celebrating someone that goes through something like this and blaming a victim when it's not really their fault?
That is a tough line, and I'll tell you why. I talk about what I went through in my act, and there are people that come over to me after the show and say, wow, you know, I lost my brother or my sister or whatever, and it's really great to see you, that, you know, that you made it through. And there are other people that I can see, they're like, you know, how come you made it and my dad didn't? And I do believe that attitude has a lot to do with it. I don't think it has everything to do with it, but... my doctors told me that they could basically tell after a couple of sessions with the chemo or radiation that, you know, whether somebody has a better chance than somebody else, just totally based on where their head is at. Like some people say, you say cancer, and they go, I'm finished. And then that's, and they just never come out of that. And there are other people that go, okay, so I got this, and I'll deal with that, and then I'll move on.
But is it also possible that there's something that they're sensing that's making that an indicator? You know, correlation is not causation. The fact that their attitude might be caused by something else or something they're sensing. It just always breaks my heart, especially when we would do AIDS benefits and stuff, where they would do these huge celebrations of so-and-so was not going to give up, they weren't going to fight, they kept a positive attitude. And I would just sit there during these speeches thinking, and the guy who is really going to die and doesn't have a chance out now, who might be hearing this, what they're saying is, and this guy didn't want to live, and he didn't want to fight, and he didn't have the courage, and he didn't do that. And it always surprises me that people... except for the Onion headline, I've never seen it discussed. What about the guy who doesn't make it? Shouldn't we be saying, you're fighting hard too?
Yeah, no, we should. It's, look, I tell people almost every night on stage, and I'm going to do something this weekend that I've never done here before. My own material.
The threesome?
No, I brought it. Boy, that really fit right in there. I'm gonna do a slideshow at the end of my, I think they have a big screen that I could use, of me going through what I went through. Because I want people
this
to...
This sounds like the funniest act.
No, there are jokes to it. There are jokes to go with it. But, you know, people need to know that there are a lot of people that go, that take that journey, and that it's a round trip thing. It's not always a one way trip. And I do thank people from the stage that didn't make it, because I know, as being a survivor, but, you know, that there are people that volunteer for clinical trials and experimental medication when the doctor says, hey, there's nothing else we could do. I mean, that's the thing that really scares you. Not when the doctor says, if it doesn't work, 6 months. Because 6 months isn't tomorrow. You never, it's not like there's this urgency. It's still 6 months, and if you have any kind of hope, then you go, okay, you know what? 5 months and 15 days from now, they could come out with a cure for this, and that'll be the end of it. It's never like right away. So, but there are people that volunteer for stuff knowing that they might not make it, or they might get a placebo or whatever. And their whole mindset is, you know, I'm not going to survive, but maybe they'll learn something with me. And then that'll help others. And then I tell my fans that, you know what, you get to see me because I was in somebody else's future.
Yeah.
And that's really why I'm here. Otherwise, they wouldn't have the medication they used on me.
And we're going to take a little break. We'll be back talking to Robert Schimmel, who is at the Monte Carlo, the Lance Burton Theater, this weekend. This is Penn Jillette on the Free FM. Lawrence O'Donnell's here, too. Yeah, big Free FM, CBS Radio, PennRadio@gmail.com. PennRadio.com, here with Lawrence O'Donnell Jr. and very funny cancer survivor, Robert Schimmel. Very funny cancer survivor, who is at, for those of you in Vegas, he's at the Monte Carlo with the big Lance Burton Theater, which
That's
is one
right.
of the reasons Michael Goudeau, who is usually my my co-host, is he's the juggler for Lance Burton.
Oh,
so
yeah.
He's off and he's down trying to see the shuttle launchers. They keep postponing on him. But that's where he is right now, because Lance is taking a little break, and you're filling up the theater there. For what Friday
tonight, tomorrow night, next Friday, next Saturday night.
And you've played the Lance Burton Theater a lot, right?
Yeah,
both pre-cancer and post.
Yeah, yeah. All I remember is it's a really great place, and they make me feel at home, and they said, look, because I didn't know what to expect going in there, and mm-hmm. if it was a regular showroom, like at Bally's, mm-hmm. you know, then you'd say, okay, I'm me, I have the material that I do, and, you know, that's it. But when you get booked into the Lance Burton Theater, then you're thinking, okay, Lance is dark, and you're going into his room, mm-hmm. and he really doesn't have that kind of act.
Right.
And so...
He has, you know, half his audience is kids.
Yeah, no, I know. And so then it's like, am I allowed to do that, my material there? And they said, well, you could do anything you want. Just don't mention the trap doors. And I'm like, trap doors?
The what? The what?
The what?
The what?
Don't mention the what? Oh, you know, those guys are always joking around, aren't they, Lance?
Yeah.
Yeah, the trap doors, it's like mirrors, you know, up the sleeve. People think magicians do tricks that way, and that's exactly the way they do them.
Yeah. You know, I
up the sleeve, mirrors, and trap doors explains at least 60% of magic.
Well, I figured that stuff out when people used to say, how do they make an elephant disappear on stage? Well, should have asked James Cagney when they brought him up on the elevator from the stage at the Academy Awards. Where did he come from? All of a sudden, ladies and gentlemen, James Cagney. There you go.
Well, you could be, you know, the setup is there to lower you from a chandelier. I mean, I'm surprised you didn't negotiate with Lance to have that be your entrance.
Yeah.
And now here he is, Robert, right down from the ceiling, just like he should be.
It is something to. I love magic, though, and you know, the whole thing is it's almost like you hear about screenplays or movies that, you know, the good guy's not going to get killed in the end, mm-hmm. and you don't care about that. It's not the twist at the end that makes the story. It's the journey that mm-hmm. takes you there. So I think that if you watch a magician or a ventriloquist, if they're really great at that, then it doesn't make any difference if you've seen somebody make something else disappear. I've still seen people do things where I go, how did they do that? And it's just... It's that.
Yeah, well,
that's what magic is that you're not going, oh, I know how he did that.
Well, there isn't really... Really one of the finest things ever said about magic was... Steinmeier, who has several books out on it, and he's the guy that used to do all the Copperfield stuff. Jim Steinmeier has written this wonderful book called Vanishing the Elephant, I think. And he has this great quote that is so profound. The more you know about magic, the smarter it is. He said, magicians are guarding an empty vault. We are protecting secrets that don't exist. We have to make people think that, we'll go to Penn & Teller. You know, we've had, like, rock guys come to us and say, you know, we want to hire you guys because you guys know magic and we want to vanish. We want to be on stage singing and then vanish and then appear in the audience. And we go, okay, well, we're going to have to, I guess we'll get a double and try to switch you. And they go, no, we want to, you go, no. All the rules of physics are still the same. You know, the big secret of magic is how much work people are willing to do. You see a card trick, you look at the card trick, you see how amazing it is, and somewhere in your head, you do the calculation of how long you'd be willing to work to make that trick happen. And it comes out to, I'd do a good 20 minutes on that. And then you run through the calculation and go, it's impossible with that much work. What you haven't thought about is that guy. That guy spent 8 hours a day for 2 years.
Oh.
So at that level, it's not impossible, but you would never make that choice. So right. the very lack of power of the trick is what conceals the secret. You know, there's stuff that I've talked to people about how hard I worked on a trick, and they just kind of go, it's a good trick, you know. So Lance Burton's trap doors are not the real secret. It's the way it is.
My son was in his show. I have a 7-year-old son, they asked me if he liked magic, and he's never seen anything, you know, live. And so we went to see Lance's show the night before I was there, and he picked my son to be the kid in the Corvette that disappears, and. So my son's up there, he's in the car, all of a sudden, boom, the car disappears, and you hear, hey, I'm up here, and there's Lance up in the chandelier in the back of the showroom, and, you know, and then he tells some joke about, do I want my kid back or the Corvette, and, you know, like he's going to give me the Corvette, and, then here comes my son running from the back of the theater, and the place goes nuts. And, you know, he's on stage, and then he gives him some coins or whatever. Well, then after the show, and he was really nice to my son. I mean, he invited him into the green room for like a half an hour and posed for pictures and autographs, the whole thing.
Magicians are like that with little boys.
I mean, yeah. And but then I said, and we got back to the room, and I said, okay, so how'd you get out of the car? Magic. I said, Jacob, there's no such thing. Now, come on. What, did somebody grab you and you ran up to the other side? It's magic, Dad. That's all I can say. I said, I'm your father. This guy you're never going to see again for the rest of your life. You want an iPod? How'd you get to the back of the theater? I'll get you the PlayStation right now. Matt, he still hasn't told me. He will not tell me.
Show business professional.
I don't know what it is that Lance told him. No, seriously, but my son will just not give it up.
And the Jesuits need you the first 7 years. Lance only needs you for those 5 seconds backstage.
The reason, you know, I think that Lance is smart in one way, that he only works with, like, ducks and chickens in his act. And, you know, unlike Siegfried and Roy, where it's like, whoa! So, I knew that was going to happen. You get a tiger that God created in the jungle. That's where it belongs. You know, spray paint him white and take him to Las Vegas and put him on stage with lasers and lights and music and two fags running around up there. How long do you think it was going to be before the tiger's like, this is going to end right now? So, I mean, seriously. And I knew that Roy would be the one to get it, because Siegfried never does anything. I remember my parents took me to see them when I was a kid, and Roy was the one that always stuck his head in the tiger's mouth, and Siegfried's like, da-da! Hey, how about that, ladies and gentlemen? Yeah, how about that? What are you doing exactly?
And, you know, and Siegfried would agree with you 100%. Siegfried has always hated the animals, you know. And I would talk to Siegfried and just go, he'd just go, Roy's crazy with that, you know.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, I worked in the circus for a while. I was Ringling Brothers. And they would walk the tigers on leashes around, you know, these big, yeah, like, macho guys. I have a rapport with the tiger,
yeah,
and they would make fun of me because they would bring the tiger out on the floor. I would go to the nearest room and lock myself in. I would just say, you know, every organism, every living organism on Earth, every species has the possibility of going
snapping.
Crazy. Exactly. So you don't know. You might have Charlie Manson tiger. You haven't done the tests. So even if you have this ability to communicate with beasts, how do you know you're not talking to Jeffrey Dahmer the tiger?
Yeah.
And he's being really nice with you now, but soon you're going to be in the refrigerator, you know?
Yeah. I know. Well, you know, Siegfried really was like as legally as far away as you could be from Roy and still be on the hotel property.
Yeah.
With the wireless mic, so that way he would still work in the parking lot while he was running. I remember the night that happened, and they were on the news, and Siegfried said the tiger did not attack Roy. He thought he was having like a stroke or something, and he was dragging him off to safety. The tiger thought he was having a stroke. Hey, looks like Roy's having a stroke. Maybe I'll bite his head off. That should lower his blood pressure.
He still insists that.
I know.
Siegfried still insists that he had high blood pressure, and it was the tiger's way of alleviating the high blood pressure.
Yeah.
But the tiger's skills were not that sophisticated.
Yeah.
So the only way it could think of.
It didn't really finish med school yet. I remember when he's on the news and he said, I just saw Roy and, well, he couldn't talk. Yeah, talk about what? I mean, what was he going to say? Where were you? Man, some boyfriend I got.
Well, you know, he insisted that the tiger not be punished in any way.
I know. I saw an interview with Maria Shriver with them, and they said the tiger still lives with them in the compound, and he said that we're not afraid of him. Yeah, I want to hear Roy say that. We're not afraid.
Yeah, it's always, and you know, I'd go backstage with Siegfried and Roy, and the animals were around there, and you wouldn't catch me anywhere near them.
What do you mean the animals were around?
Well, you know, they have little cages backstage.
Oh, okay.
But they can take one of those, you know, paws and go out through the, you know, it's really dangerous stuff. And I mean, we also have Steve Irwin, who told that, showed us that, you know, you stick your head in crocodiles' mouths and you run around, something's bound to happen, you know. And I just think, and Roy was doing a nutty thing because he was taking something really, really dangerous and making it look easy, which to me is the opposite of show business. Take something really easy and make it look really dangerous. That's what you're supposed to do. You know, that's the Bruce Willis school. He's healthy and fine and rich, right? He's not. He hasn't had his head torn off by a tiger.
Yeah.
We're gonna be back after this with Robert Schimmel. This is Ben Gillette. We're on Free FM. Yeah, this is Ben Gillette here on the Free FM. That's Jimmy McIntosh playing the guitar with the big Mike Jones Orchestra playing the Ben Gillette theme. You can find all that music and more jazz on PennRadio.com. That's Penn with two N's. Sitting with Lawrence O'Donnell Jr. and also Robert Schimmel, who promised us before you came on that you were going to tell the story of your mom meeting Lexington Steele. I think was billboarded before we got on the air.
That's right.
We would very much want to hear that.
Okay, so I get asked to host the AVN Awards, which is Adult Video Awards. And my manager, Lee Kernis, said, you know, I don't want you doing that, and it's not a real good career move. And, you know, and then I said, but I get to share a dressing room with the girls. And he said, can I get a backstage pass?
And they said, say anything you want, just don't mention the trap doors of the girls.
Yeah. it's unreal. So they actually sent me every movie that was nominated for an award,
of course,
3 weeks before the awards, in case I wanted to watch them and write jokes about them. Because, you know, there's a lot of joke writing going on when you're watching porno. And, let me stop what I'm doing and grab a pen and write this down. So one of the movies that was nominated for Best Foreign Adult Film was called Budapest Gangbang. And the star of it's this guy, Lexington Steele. And I don't recognize the name, but once you see him, you would definitely know who he is. I mean, let's just say there was a building on fire and people were sliding down him to safety. So, well, my mom and dad are both from Budapest. That's where they grew up. And so I wanted to give my dad some crap one day. He's visiting me and I said, hey, look, Dad, Budapest Gangbang. And my dad said, I'd like to borrow that and see if there's any places I remember in my life. And I'm like, yeah, right. So then I was doing the awards. They were at Caesar's Palace, and part of the deal was you get two suites on the concierge floor, and you sign for everything in these, like, VIP suites. So I take my parents up there, not to go see the awards, but I could put them in a room that they've never stayed in before and sign for meals, see another show, and we'll hang out after. So we are at the elevator bank checking in, and 15 feet away from us is Lexington Steele, and my mom recognizes him, which means she saw the movie, too.
That's great.
And she's 70 years old, and she points to him and goes, Budapest Gangbang, right? And I'm like, oh, my God. I don't know who feels worse, me, that my mother is recognizing this porno guy, or Lexington Steele, who's probably thinking, great, this is what I attract.
Yeah.
So, and then my mother goes over to him and starts talking to him and says, will you please tell my son that you're not really that big? Ma, walk away, will you? Because you don't know.
She didn't really say that.
She did.
Oh, that's fabulous.
She did. She said, Bob, you think it's real? She said, you talk about sex in your act, and then this you fall for? And I said, Ma, walk away, please. I said, you don't know him. He could do you, Dad, and me at the same time and still have enough to push the elevator button. So... And she keeps talking to him. Last year, I'm doing radio to promote a date. No, it's in January. I was performing at the Monte Carlo. It's the same week as the CES show, and that's when they have the AVN Awards.
Sure.
So I'm doing a radio show, and like I said, after the break, we're going to have a couple people come in from AVN. And who walks in? Lexington Steele. And the first thing he says is, hey, how's your mom doing? And I'm like, oh, God. This guy remembers my mother? That's really bad.
That's bad. Did you talk to her about it afterward? Did she tell you to shut up? Did she talk to whoever she wanted to?
Yeah. And then she said, she said, what's the big deal? She said, do you think I've never seen anybody undressed before? And I'm like, wow, I can't believe it. Man, he was a really nice guy, though, but he asked about my mom immediately.
On the air?
Yeah, so on the air.
So you had a little explaining to do? So you're at the Monte Carlo once again.
Yeah.
And it's this
tonight,
weekend and next weekend.
Tomorrow night. Yeah, and yeah, next weekend. And I really do love it there. It's, you know, I always thought when you first start out, you think Vegas, yeah, I don't know. That's where everybody goes. That's like the elephant burial grounds or whatever, and it really isn't. And the audiences here are, they really come for a good time. And, you know, New York has a certain kind of audience. I mean, you know, traveling around.
Sure.
And Chicago has one, and San Francisco, and they're all different. But you come here, and it's that's like the real thing. It's, you get people from all over the country and all over the world that come to this one city to have, like, the best time of their life. And the shows are, like, amazing. I mean, it's, you really cannot be on, anybody that I've seen up here is never on autopilot. They really are performing for real up here.
Yeah.
And it's staggering to me because I look down the strip and see the names of everybody else that's here, like, when I'm here, and I'm thinking, yeah, what, am I going to have three people in the audience? So, because I see nine shows I'd like to go see.
Yeah, well, the great thing is when we used to play here, you know, we're now here 48 weeks a year, but when we used to play here like 12 weeks a year, I remember, you know, relatives and girlfriends and maybe me once in a while, you go through the postcard rack and you can find one of these aerial, beautiful shots of Vegas where you're on the marquee.
Oh, wow.
And it's just the greatest thing in the world. And, you know, Monte Carlo's in all of those, and you can't tell where they're going to take a picture. So when you got nothing to do, you go to the postcard shop and go, oh, yeah, I need oh, by the way, as you're checking out, that's my name on the marquee. It's a pretty great thing because it's such an image of that strip, and you think that those names, you know, you still look at that and see Dean Martin.
I was just
Buddy
thinking
Hackett.
That Buddy Hackett,
that's
and Frank Sinatra,
think.
And Sammy Davis Jr.
And
yeah.
That's what you're always picturing, that they're going to have those up there when they take the pictures. But they're still taking pictures, and they're still putting them on calendars, and you can pop up there. And it's a really nutty thing when you go to the world's largest gift shop, which is a lie. It's not they advertise the world's largest gift shop. It's not the world's largest gift shop. South of the border. In South Carolina, I think is a bigger gift shop than the one here. I don't mean to be like anti-Vegas. I know we live here. I know it's real cool. Not the biggest goddamn gift shop. So,
yeah, but they also don't have the strip there.
Exactly,
so.
Exactly. They have nothing but the gift shop. And where did you start out? You started in New York?
I started in L.A. Actually, what happened was my sister got me into show business. I always watched comedians. I mean, we were talking before when I came in about Jackie Vernon, who was one of my favorites. And I used to watch Ed Sullivan all the time and all these shows. I loved comedians. I loved making people laugh. Never really had the push to go and try and be a stand-up comic. I was married, had a daughter already. Managing a high-end stereo store in Scottsdale, Arizona. We owned a house. And I came to visit my sister in L.A., and my sister said, you want to go to the Improv? I didn't even know what the Improv was.
What year?
1978. Says, let's go to the Improv. I said, okay. She said, it was all comics there. So I was excited to see comedians. And Seinfeld was there, and George Wallace, and...
Wow. Sure.
Whatchamacallit? Oh... trying to think of the guy that used to do the stagecoach thing with the sound effects, and he's in movies now. He doesn't do stand. Tim, somebody, a lot of great people. Anyway, she takes me on amateur night and signs me up without telling me. So the way it works is you put your name on a piece of paper, they put it in a bucket, and the MC pulls the name out, and you get 2 minutes on stage, and they had an egg timer that they had on stage. Mm-hmm. So my sister puts my name in there.
Very soft egg.
Bud Friedman himself is the MC on amateur night there, and he pulls my name out and says, Robert Schimmel. And I'm like, what? And my sister goes, come on, you're funny, get up there. And I'm like, what are you doing? I don't do this. And Bud's going, come on, Robert, where are you? You know, because they want to cut with, don't we want him to get up here? And the whole audience is going, yeah, and there's nothing to be afraid of.
Schimmel.
I go up there, I do 2 minutes, I had no material, and I was just talking about how I was a stereo salesman and I didn't belong up there, and... when I came off, Bud said, you know what? You're really funny. He said, call in for spots. So I go home, tell my wife, this is it. I'm going to quit the job. We're selling the house. We're going to move to L.A. We're going to live with my sister for a few weeks until we find an apartment. And I am going to be a comedian. So we pack up all of our stuff. We get a U-Haul. We get off the Hollywood Freeway on the Melrose exit because I'm going to show my wife the improv where I'm going to be working, and it burnt down the night before we got there.
You are a joke.
And Bud Friedman was standing outside of the club talking to like insurance guys, and the fire. The place was still smoldering, and the street was wet from the fire engines. And my wife was like, "Oh no!" And I said, "Don't worry, I'm sure they have insurance." And she said, "Who cares about them? You quit your job." And I said to Bud, "Hey, wow, what happened?" And he said, "Who are you?" And I said, "What, you told me I can come back?" And he said, "Can't you see that my club burned down?" But he gave me my first start, and he's been really nice. That's it. Then I wrote for Jimmy Walker. Jimmy Walker, who is a really nice guy, but had a rule sheet when you wrote jokes for him, because I wrote for him, and Mitchell Walters and all these people. And on the very top of the sheet, it says, "Absolutely no jokes with dynamite in the punchline."
But you could have it in the setup.
And it was like, wait a minute, how many jokes could have dynamite in it? Then I heard this rumor, I don't know if it's true or not, that he wouldn't say dynamite, and that he was actually in Vegas performing somewhere, and they offered him like 20 grand or 30 grand to say it, and he said no.
That can't be true.
If it is, I got to tip my hat to the guy, because that's crazy. Then I wrote for Joan Rivers and Yakov Smirnoff. I got double booked into a club where it was my first time headlining, and Yakov Smirnoff, his name was on the marquee, too. It said Yakov Smirnoff and Robert Schimmel. It was the last laugh in San Jose, and they said, "We made a mistake. We did a double booking, but you know what? We'll give you the same money, but you go on first." And I said, "You got to be kidding." And they said, and tone down your act, because Yakov's completely clean and everything. And I didn't want to do that. I mean, I would rather not do the show than not be myself on stage.
Sure.
So I really went for broke. And it wasn't anything against Yakov, but I just had to show them that I belonged to, I wanted to close the show. So I just really went for it. And at the end, I said, "You know, you guys have been the best crowd I've ever been in front of, and I wish my mom and dad were here to see the show tonight. But they were killed in Hungary in 1956 during the uprising. Good night." I walk off, and Yakov came out in that Russian outfit.
Oh, oh, oh.
And got booed off the stage.
That is so much better than Jerry Lee Lewis having to open for Chuck Berry and lighting his piano on fire. That is great. And did you ever have a conversation with Yakov?
Later that night, yes. He asked me if I would write for him for the rest of the week because he wanted to be able to follow me.
That is fabulous. That is fabulous. So you were just a stereo guy?
Yeah.
Who just came out, did amateur night, and you were there? Did you have any kids at that time?
Yeah, I had a daughter who was, she was about 8-9 months old then. And then I got a job selling stereo equipment in L.A. at Beverly Stereo, right by La Cienega in Beverly. And I remember selling a stereo system to Steve Martin, and he said, "You're going to come to my house and install it, right?" And he lived on Bedford or wherever it was. He had no windows in his house for some reason. It was a really bizarre thing.
For hanging art. Yeah.
And I'm in his room running speaker wires and stuff, right? And he's in there and he's going, and I said, "You know, I'm a comedian too." And he said, "Yeah, that's why you're installing my stereo."
That's Robert Schimmel. He's at Lance Burton Theater at the Monte Carlo here in Las Vegas, Nevada. I'm Penn Jillette, sitting here with Lawrence O'Donnell Jr.